It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Good morning. This is Delmarva Today. I'm Gretchen Hansen, sitting in for Don Rush. This morning, we will be examining the current status of family reunification and whether the administration has kept to court-imposed deadlines. Today, I'm honored to have back my guest, Attorney Alan Orr with Orr Immigration in Washington, D.C. Mr. Orr is the recipient of the 2009 Joseph Minsky Young Lawyer Award for contributions made to the immigration law field. He is listed in the international who's who of corporate immigration lawyers and is on the executive committee for a national spokesperson for AILA. Alan, it is a pleasure to have you back. Could you walk us through the deadline that has passed regarding reunification with toddler children? And how many children are still separated from their parents?
Well, thank you for having me back. I think it's super important that we sort of keep this in the fair front. And sort of to give you an update is that it's sort of a fail on the government part by the court-imposed effort. Out of the 103 kids that were supposed to be unified, and I say kids loosely, I should actually say babies and toddlers because they're under five, of the 103, only 58 of them were actually reunited with their family. And most of them were not done by July 10th, which was the deadline. Some were done on July 11th, and some were done on July 12th, right? And then out of that category of people, that conversation was the government found that 33 parents were ineligible for criminal reasons, but never really gave us an understanding of what the crimes were, right? What were the disqualifying grounds of that sort of classification? And then also 12 of the parents had already been deported by the time the kids were going to be released to them. So the reunification had to happen somewhere else. And so that also sort of presented a problem. And so the real issue as to why, you know, I think the media is not sort of beating down the doors of the government again, because this was a very weak spot for the Trump administration on a humanitarian ground, is because of all the news right now surrounding Russia, right? The Russia meeting and the Putin meeting had sort of put all of this in the background when the first order court date was missed drastically. I mean, only half of the kids were actually returned. That should be marching grounds for everyone who cares about human rights and humanity.
So are you saying that you believe that the Trump administration put this in the background because they created more chaos surrounding NATO and the Putin meeting, that they actually did that deliberately to take the immigration question out of the public eye?
Absolutely. I think every time there's, you know, on these major court dates, there's these major announcements that always sort of happen to sort of put these things in the back shadow and sort of keeping the chaos at the forefront in all other arenas, right, whatever they may be, right, to keep you distracted from the weak spot is a known Trump administration. Here's another example. This week, the House of Representatives took a vote on the so-called Abolish ICE Amendment. And rather than make it an Abolish ICE Amendment, they changed the language to say it was a Support ICE Amendment, right? And so even within this conversation, when Democrats were so mad and were so over ICE and Abolish ICE, still a majority, all the Republicans voted, except for one, voted in favor of this proposition to say we support ICE in their efforts, and 130-something Democrats voted in support of that. The interesting thing about that is that the House had the time to take up the issue of Abolish ICE without taking up the issue of DACA, without taking up the issue of this family reunification issue itself specifically, or any of the other immigration issues, right? Totally for a political purpose to push the news in a different direction. And so that's where the Abolish ICE has actually become a distraction from what is actually happening to these kids in the reunification effort.
I'd like to go back to something that you said a little bit ago. You said 33 parents were ineligible to get their children back. Now, one of the things that I read about as I was preparing for this is that they were ineligible because they had crossed the border at a non-crossing zone. So they had crossed illegally, and that made them ineligible. Is that one of the reasons it's being purported that their children are not being returned?
Right. So the ACLU actually didn't get, they asked for and have not had a complete statement, which was part of the regress for the court, for the government missing the deadline, to have a specific understanding of what those crimes may be, right? And part of the issue may be that they entered the United States before and were deported before, right? Mm-hmm. So the same misdemeanor issue, the same slow-level crime issue that sort of happened. And so that's one of the things. But we're not really sure, and that's part of the problem. in this first cohort of people, right before there was a plan, they announced a plan on Wednesday of this week when they were already supposed to be reunifying families before then, was that they originally were doing a lot of DNA testing, right?
Right.
Which takes a considerable amount of time, right? Because what I want you to think about is that all of these kids, the remaining kids, the remaining cohort of kids that we're talking about, if you sort of now forget about the babies, there's a class of around 2,500 kids that are in 106 locations around the United States, right?
Right.
So the concept of sort of getting them back with their parents who are in another organization. So kids are currently in HHS, right? Healthcare Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are with ICE, right? Different facilities, different locations, different branches of the government. And sort of matching them up is the complication. And originally what they were doing were they were doing a lot of DNA testing and saying, well, this isn't your kid because your blood doesn't match or whatever the circumstance may be for every one of the kids. Well, that's costly and time-consuming, right? So now they're only doing that after initial screening and background check if it proves for something else. The challenge for that for me is that what if the kid's from a non-traditional family, right? What if they're adopted? What if it's an aunt or an uncle taking care of a kid because the family didn't survive for some other gang violence? That's not a valid way to sort of test the family relationship in all cases is if the blood matches, right? So that's one of the complications that was there. The other complication that we still have is that everything is happening behind a blind wall, right? You still haven't seen the girls. You actually haven't seen any of them, right? You haven't seen the babies, right? The only time that we actually recently have started hearing about the babies, the one-year-olds, are when they're making their court appearances now to plead their cases for asylum at 1 and 2 years old, right? Which seems outrageous.
So I'd like to go back to something you said about non-traditional families. What is the plan for reunifying children that come from non-traditional families? According to this number, there's still almost 50 kids that are unaccounted for, toddlers that are unaccounted for, that haven't been returned.
Right. So the answer that I want to give you that is there is no plan. There's never been a plan.
Okay.
And not having a plan is part of the chaos that creates the problems that the Trump administration loves. As we discussed last time, it's the same thing that happened with the Muslim ban. We're going to do this overnight. There's no plans. There's going to be total chaos at the airports. People are going to be distracted and disadvantaged. There are going to be lawyers showing up everywhere. Chaos, mass chaos. Nobody really cared, right? Right? The same sort of chaos and consideration we've started having every now with the DACA people, right? As the president, I can't have this program go on any longer. I'm going to end it, right?
Right.
So now these kids who had status now won't have status. Well, the court has put an injunction to that, but it caused just this fury of, well, will I have status or will I have this uncertainty? Right? And that's how the administration sort of likes to govern in this chaos. And while you're sort of looking at one thing, they're doing something else on the other end. For example, while we're talking about the people who are coming here lawfully to apply for a visa process called asylum,
right,
which is in our visa laws, so therefore they're not illegal at any point as long as they're applying for this process like any other visa applicant at any other port of entry, right?
Right.
They have now decided to change what asylum means, right?
Does this have something to do with Paul Ryan changing it from gang violence and domestic violence? Is that...
Actually, it's Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions.
Yeah. Jeff Sessions changed it from the Department of Justice. And 72 former U.S. attorneys have said, this is not who we are, this is not what we do, and it's not consistent with U.S. policy, right? Or worldwide policy. Because the concept of asylum is an international policy, and sort of removing it in these contexts of saying we need specifically to see that the government was coming for you to have political asylum here, not that it was the gang or some other arm of the government or, you know, abuse from your husband who's part of a gang who's also working covertly with the government becomes extremely problematic, right?
So how long?
And so releasing those grounds sort of removes, you know, what it does is it eliminates a wide percentage of the cases that are already filed, right? Because their arguments are already set up. They've already said, you know, it was my husband,
right,
gang violence, right? So those are still in the queue and not before a judge yet, right? And that's within the power of the Department of Justice to make these findings. But what it does is It tells CBP at the port of at the gate to say, if someone comes to you now and they say it's domestic violence or it's gang violence, you tell them, go away.
So how long have our asylum laws been in place, and what does it mean for our democracy to no longer have safe asylum laws?
So after World War II is when the sort of platform sort of started for this refugee program. So many years ago, it's not something new, right? And this sort of change, you know, happened overnight. And what now lawyers are doing are saying, of course, we're going to fight this in court, sort of understanding what the ramifications of this is, because here's the issue. The way this happened is there was a case, there was an asylum case that was going before a judge, right? And what the attorney general did was he certified the case to himself, right? And then he rendered a decision on the case himself that eliminated these grounds. So it is the police officer, right, the Department of Justice, also being the judge, right, making a ruling on your consideration. And in no way is that consistent with U.S. policy.
Right? Is that consistent with due process? Because that sounds
it's
like it violates
due process.
Due process.
Right? The person who arrests you cannot be the person who also tries you. Right? That does not give you an impartial finding. Right? What is your argument against the cop that stops you if the cop is saying, okay, now we're going to have your case here,
right,
and I stopped you? And, of course, every evidence they present is going to be stronger than the evidence you present because it's their own evidence.
So the U.S. has recently been downgraded by The Economist to a flawed democracy. Do you think this is in part due to our changing laws about asylum?
I think it's in part due to a lot of different things. The main problem that we have right now is the inability for Congress to act. Because in everything that we're talking about in the immigration context, Congress can solve it. All they need to do is talk about it in both houses, right? And I would love to think, you know, years ago the Senate passed an immigration bill, and there was actually a conversation in the Senate again. But our main problem right now is the House, right? We're 109 days away from the midterm election, and that's the way we cure our democracy, by fixing, hopefully replacing, you know, some people with other people who are ready to make deals and be leaders and to actually deal with policies that are consistent with our Constitution rather than politics.
So I was going to ask you about the midterm elections. Do you think that this inaction in the House has partly to do with the midterm elections and the fact that they're afraid of bringing down the wrath of the Trump administration on them if they challenge the administration?
It has everything to do with the midterms election. Even this concern of saying there's a crisis at the border is theater for the midterm election, right? As we stated last call, every day, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people show up at U.S. ports of entry, right? Today I'm in New York. I can go right now to LaGuardia and see tons and tons of planes, dumb people here to come to the United States and either enter on a visa they already have or some other sort of processing for security checks, right? And none of them are told to wait 2 to 3 days. So the concept that our country, being what it is, cannot process whatever number of people are showing up at the port of entry on that specific day for whatever they need to be processed for in an appropriate way seems unintelligible to me, right? We have had conversations about going to the moon. Forget the moon. We're going to Mars, sorry, right, for this war station. But we can't process people who are applying for legal entries at our south border. So all of this is to sort of bolster the Trump administration policy of saying, your concern is that there are a number of people in the United States that are undocumented. I'm going to fix that for you.
Is it really about the southern border, though? I mean, one of the things that we've discussed in the past and on other calls is that people are not being blocked as they immigrate from Norway. They're not being blocked if they immigrate from Sweden, but they're being blocked if they immigrate from Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico.
Right. So there are two things. The people at our southern border are black and brown, and generally from lower classes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's problematic for the Trump administration's sort of new qualification of what a merit system should be. And for me, there's nothing more meritorious than a young mother grabbing their child, walking hundreds or thousands of miles to a U.S. border to say, I need protection because someone's going to kill us, right? That's the concept of who you would pull for in a movie, right?
Right.
So the concept is that's the reason why the southern border is sort of there, right? The other issue, there is a little bit of a wall sort of being built around in legal immigration as well, of sort of saying, we don't really trust others that much. But even in the policy factors behind those sort of walls, it is from sort of specific countries, more specific religions that have a higher scrutiny or a higher change. And all of those things are also arbitrary. So a little bit of this make America first is keep America white, and keep America white in the way that we're white, right? Because sometimes you'll find that European people are more consistent with liberals in the thought about, you know, sort of cultural assimilation than they are with individuals who may be found in some of our southern states. And that could be problematic.
So you're saying that Trump has basically built a virtual wall on the southern border so that, you know, he can't build the actual physical wall. That's not happening. But he's built a virtual wall to keep people out.
So he's built this virtual wall to keep overall and all immigration, A, specifically in the southern border for this sort of group. But I will tell you that there is now a physical wall there based on reports of U.S. Congress people who have visited the border who are now saying, and other lawyers who have been there, they're now saying, CBP is not allowing these individuals to actually touch the United States anymore for the same reasons I just told you, right?
Right.
Meaning they're going to assess them before they reach the United States and say, you no longer qualify. Asylum is different now. You have no papers to show the government's doing this for you. You need to either deal with the Mexican government or go back to wherever you may come from, right? So now they have physical CBP officers outside the zones of the United States.
Is that legal?
Turning people away. That is not legal.
Okay.
That is not the way the process should work. Right?
So they're denying these people actual due process of seeking asylum. So asylum laws, we allow asylum. It's legal to claim asylum, but they're not allowing people to actually claim asylum. So they're actually limiting their due process. Is that correct?
All due process under immigration, or all due process in immigration, is under siege.
Okay.
And being removed. The further you down, the darker you are in hue, the less due process you have, as well as the less you have in wealth, right? Because the other major problem is, in this category of people, where they're sort of herding them through these courts, only 14% of them have some form of legal representation to know what their rights are, to know what it is to sort of immigrate or what asylum means. And outside of that, there is a government program, right? Because we're really good. We're the United States, right? Mm-hmm. We're the great democracy that is supposed to go in, that is funded by the government to go in and make sure these people know that what their rights are, here's what's going to happen to you, here's the process, right? Here's the procedure, right? And so in that program, out of the 200 facilities we have, it's only in 38 of them.
Wow.
Right? Right? And people say, oh, well, it's funding. We don't have funding for this, and it costs money. Well, right now, apparently, we've spent $40 million separating these families, right?
Where's that money coming from?
So part of the money is coming from a deficit, clearly. Mm-hmm. The new funding that's coming to sort of do this, the family housing, is coming from health care benefits. Specifically noted, it's supposedly coming from the Ryan White bill, so it's coming from AIDS patients, basically. And AIDS research is where they're moving the money from to sort of keep these children detained. And so part of what happened when they missed the first court date was the court said, you know, part of your penalty for this is that no longer when you release these families can you look at the mom and say, I need you to pay $2,000 to be reunited with your kid, right? The court has established that the government set up a fund to sort of help these families be unified.
Right.
You know, that's sort of short goal. So a lot of celebrities, foundations, individual wealthy donors are sort of helping unite these families and their kids to defray the costs, right? To sort of say, okay, in some cases, these individuals are making valid asylum claims, so they're released in California, and then their kids in Georgia, and the government's saying, okay, go meet your kid at this airport, right?
So who's paying for that to happen? Is the government paying for that?
The government will be paying for that. Right now, other donors are sort of stepping in to make sure these families are unified, right? Donors, foundations are sort of saying, because, you know, that's really the problem right now, that these individuals with nothing are being harassed the most, either by coyotes who are extorting them to get here, right? Hundreds of thousands of dollars of their family, or trapping them between South America and the United States border and saying, you need $300 each to be released, right, in order to move forward. And then once you're in the United States, we're saying, tell you what, I'm going to take your kids. You have to earn them back from me. You can talk to them if you have money on your card to call them, right?
Right.
That's the other issue that they don't talk about. If the money is not always, yeah, you can call them twice a week if you have the money to call them on the card from. The government's not providing you with that ability to just call them for free, right? That's one. And then once you're free and you've cleared our process, which is the legal process, then we're going to allow you to have your kids back. Well, actually, we're going to test you to see if they're your kids first, and then we'll give them back to you.
So I also saw that people were required to put up a bond. Is that real?
No. So what that does is a bond is to sort of show that you will show up in court.
Right.
And there has been some notice that the bond has been high in certain cases that people can't afford it to sort of go through this process. And that's something that's sort of going to be litigated on a state-by-state, court-by-court sort of level, inconsistency among the immigration courts. That's something that came out the other day. But, yeah, the bonds are deterrents, right? And the other sort of part of the wall that we didn't talk about, which I should talk about, is that after you come into a legal port, right, and they take your kid from you, then they may be offered to say, you know what, I don't think you're really qualified for this, but if you sign this document for, you know, expedited removal, I'll get your kid back.
Wow.
Right? And there are reported cases of that. And those are sort of on sort of the top edges of what's supposed to happen, where everything is supposed to be resolved by July 26th, which is, you know, basically next week. And I don't really think that that's going to happen. And out of the cohort of the 2,500 kids, they said that 719 of those parents have final deportation orders. So basically, they're going to reunite them to deport them. But the interesting thing about this is that all of this three department U.S. plan was established under the concern of saying, we're looking out for the welfare of these children. That's why we took them from the parents, and that's going to be our grounds for reuniting them. Even yesterday at the Aspen sort of summit, the DHS secretary said, this is really about child welfare, right?
I saw that, yes.
Which I think is interesting. If someone came in your house and said, I'm going to take your kids from you until you can prove to me that you need to have them, it's an interesting concept. Doesn't follow due process, right? It's really, you have to show that you don't have, that these kids aren't yours, then I'll take them from you, right? It's sort of reverse due process,
right?
Reverse legal systems here, where someone's removed and then you have to prove a negative, right? When you're already at a disadvantage, perhaps, you know, they don't know your dialect of language, right? You've already traveled thousands of miles, you are malnourished, blah, blah, blah. Which I really want to sort of tell you, for me, which is the second issue that I think the public really needs to focus on, because this is a contact Congress, this is not who the United States is sort of moment, right?
Explain that. I'm sorry, Alan. Could you explain that to our listeners?
Meaning that we should stand up as the public and say this is not who we are, regardless of what party you are in.
Right.
Because this really isn't about a Democratic or Republican issue. This is about what are the principles that the United States is founded on. And in every state, the welfare of the child is first. Even if you have children or you don't have children, that concept should not be remote for you, right?
So you're saying this is a human rights abuse?
Absolutely. Past human rights abuse. I mean, this is past what I would consider human rights abuse for the United States. This is not who we are, right? This is just generally not the concept. And part of that is when we are detaining these children by our own officials, we're not making sure they're getting the right type of health care and safety they need. There have been a number of reports of sexual violations of minors in these facilities that has come to be true, right? So that is a screening, hiring process, right? Just like we sort of think about our teachers. We're not going to put a teacher in a room with a bunch of kids that's a sexual violator,
right?
Nor should we be hiring people to work at these for-profit facilities that are violating kids. Those are anomalies, right?
Was HHS equipped to handle this number of children, like, flooding into the system?
So, you know, you broke it, you bought it, right? We're the United States. We need to be able to sort of build what we need to deal with the problems that we have. So, yes, right? That is what they do for a living, right?
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to assess this. But the issue is, it's not just HHS that is doing it. You're HHS in the news, but the actual facilities are run by local private companies that are for profit.
Right.
That's the problem, right? That's the issue with that. So you have the abuse that's anomalies, but more specifically is now their health care problem, mm-hmm. where people aren't being given the drugs they need to survive, or they're being exposed to bad water or bad food, right? And for me, it's a Good Samaritan sort of concept, right?
Right.
You brought them in. You said you were going to help them. So if you make them sick, you need to make them whole. So a number of the kids that have been returned to their families now have health problems.
Right? In addition to the psychological damage that's been
done. In addition to the psychological damage. It will never be fixed, right? You'll never be able to fix that, right? That's just broken for all times. But these issues about malnourished, bad water, bad food, sexual harassment by the U.S. government, right? Those are international actionable things, right, that someone should sue the government for, right? Those are true human rights violations, right?
Has the U.N. weighed in on this?
Slavery or child, excuse me?
Has the U.N. weighed in on this?
The U.N. said it was inappropriate in the very beginning, right? But right now our relationship with the U.N. is not that great.
Right.
Right? So it's not really, you know, the U.N. is not going to come in and do some wartime trial with us. I mean, I think there have been a lot of, even Mexico, our neighbor, has had these conversations of saying, quit saying that it's Mexicans coming in because there's a negative immigration rate for Mexico right now.
Right.
Right. So that's just not the case. But there are a lot of international organizations that are speaking out against it, but we don't need an international organization to tell us what American is. We are America, right? We're supposed to know these things better than anyone else. So as the people, once we're informed, then we are obligated to act. Right. No longer should we ignore these things, regardless of the conversations that are happening about Putin and Russia and everything else. Right. Great. We can have those conversations and we'll have this one as well. Right. Because this one is an easily resolvable issue if the government put its effort and energies behind it. That's the most important thing I want you to remember. If we wanted to solve this problem, if it was important enough, we would. Right?
So I'd like to go back to the numbers. Solve this problem. How many children still need to be reunified with their parents? How many children's parents are missing? How many children are missing?
Right. So here's the problem. We're asking the fox to give us accountability of how many sheep they ate in the long run, right? So these are all government reporting, right? And you know, I have no reason to distrust the government until they give me a better reason, which is sort of their handling of this matter sort of gives me a, sort of the foundation to say, I don't know if I necessarily trust your numbers, right? So we're back at that 2,500 number, generally, that need to sort of be the larger class. And out of that sort of class of people, it's been reported that 364 people have been reunited, right?
Say again, 364?
364.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that reunited means what. Right? And the issue that we have is the sort of issue that comes out later in the fact-finding process of after you missed the date, because we don't know how many of those parents have already been deported out of that category.
So what's going to happen when the parents have already been deported? How are the children going to be reunified?
So they're reunified in the foreign country of our border that they're supposed to meet. I mean, that's really the problem, right? Because it's not, you know, it's not like you can call them up on your cell phone. Or their cell phone and say, you know, we're going to meet here, right? These concepts of modern technology that people sort of assume that people have who have been through an ordeal and spent thousands of dollars and now deported to say you're going to call a parent up and say, meet me here, mm-hmm. right? There are some contacts, don't get me wrong, but it's not as easy as it is today that you would just call someone on a cell phone. People who existed before cell phones, think about how it was when you'd have to leave a message, send a telegram, or send an email to someone to find access. Or anyone who's ever been in a foreign country that doesn't have the infrastructure of the United States, where things aren't as readily available, right? That's what you sort of go through the unification and sort of planning for the parent to be there to get the child, because that's the other issue, right? When they return these people to these countries that are hostile to them, in many cases, they are subject to murder and death for fleeing upon their return.
So we're basically dumping the problem back on the foreign country where the problem existed in the first place. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And in most cases, where the United States may have some relationship to that problem. Right? One of the things that I think that Secretary Johnson, you know, the Obama administration was not clean of any of these things. Right? And I'm not one to compare administration to another administration. I don't care about that. Right. What I care about is who we are as a country and what's the best solution for these kids. So saying Obama was better or Trump's worse, I don't really care. sit that away. They're both horrible, right?
Right.
Detaining kids and babies, all of that's horrible, right? Not the best process at all. So that doesn't really matter to me. What matters is the best resolution for the problem, and that really should be what the focus is, the best humanitarian resolution for these problems.
So, Alan, in the 3 minutes we have remaining, could you sum up what should be done and how we should be approaching this problem?
Right. So the first thing that I said is that the midterm elections are 109 days away. This is a voting issue, right? That's the only way. If Congress doesn't move on immigration, all these problems will continue to exist and be platform issues for whatever administration is running for office and an opportunity to fail. It's time to deal with the immigration issue. Number two, in no world, in no way should a prison ever be for profit. For foreign nationals, for Americans, that's not what our detention system's about. That's not who we are as a country, right? You don't make money off of prisoners, right? Because then you have an obligation to keep people in there. And that doesn't sound like due process or fair to me. If you have so many beds, you have to fill, and you've done a contract to make sure that those beds are filled every day. Number three is you need to turn the resources that you put into separating the families into putting the families back together, right? This is a crisis that we're able to fix. We are a country of millions of individuals with a very large government, right? Our current administration has solved, apparently, the jobless rate, race relations, Russian relations, and Korean relations in a matter of weeks, right? So such a powerful administration can clearly resolve the problem of 2,500 kids in a week, right? It's all about the resources that you put to the issue if you wanted to solve it.
So you're saying that the administration has the obligation to resolve this issue by putting
Absolutely.
All its resources behind the problem and fixing it.
You broke it, you bought it.
Okay. So, Alan, I'd like to thank you for being our guest again, and I'd like to really tell you what a pleasure it has been to talk to you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
Nope. Just remember, it's about the midterms. It's about the election. It's time to see immigration through. The last immigration bill happened in 1990, and that's the problem.
Thank you. Thank you. And remember to vote in the midterms. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
There you go. If you've never seen Delmarva from the sky, perhaps consider those who fly their planes every day over the peninsula. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The book is called Flying Over Delmarva, Spray Planes, Banner Planes, and Biplanes. And it brings to life those whom we barely notice, except for an occasional banner that crosses the sky off the shores of Ocean City. But there's a whole community of flyers, and Joanne Guilfoy tells the stories of the families that have dominated the air over Delmarva. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, well, first of all, what was the inspiration for this book? How did you get the idea?
About 4 years ago when I came to Delmarva, I was volunteering several days a week at the Georgetown Airport, namely the maintenance hangar, and two things happened. I realized that the mechanic there, my friend from high school, also had worked for Bob Bunting, and as a high school kid, I spent many hours in the water in Ocean City watching these banner planes, and I'd always been very curious how all that happened. I assumed they flew out of Ocean City. No, they actually fly much closer to here from a family airport. Their address is Berlin. Mm-hmm. I was anxious to find out how all that operation worked, and as I began to ask questions and write some things down, make notes. I also was introduced to many of the other pilots in the book, who some of whom came to the Georgetown Airport, some of whom I met through those fellows. And all of a sudden, I had a book on my hands, and I had to find a publisher, and then after a while, after 6 months or so, actually just go with what I had. And it basically built itself. The Bunting family is in the middle. The banner plane story, all those pilots are the kind of the backbone. And then on either side, a bit of history through the families that you'll hear about, and then the current guys that are flying crop dusters, insect patrol, I guess you would call.
Right, right.
And then some of the, also some of the folks who fly for pleasure.
So, well, let's begin with, so we have the Innes family. Tell me a little bit about the Innes family. It's sort of a father and son.
Yes. And I met Paul Innes through Calvin Peacock, who is one of the other pilots, although not highly featured here. He was sort of one of my main communicators. And he said, listen, Joanne, if you're going to write anything, you have got to include Paul Innes. He's the grandfather of aviation on Delmarva. And it turned out he was a wonderful person to meet, great family story. And so he is my he is the first grandfather of Delmarva Aviation.
So, I mean, how did he get involved with aviation, do you recall?
It was through his dad. They moved down from New York. His father was a pilot, and I was fortunate enough to have the log sheet. Anyway, his father, Fred, I really believe inspired Paul to become a pilot. And in moving to Delmarva, that's where it all got started.
And there was a plane, I guess, called the Great Lakes Aircraft?
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, this was one that his dad had, and Paul inherited it, and it took many turns in terms of building, rebuilding, but has been a member of his family now since the 30s. And it is a biplane. It's open cockpit and is, you know, as people would say nowadays, sort of a throwback to the days of open cockpit flying, rotor wing, wooden propeller, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So I want to then turn to Joe Hudson and probably the big preoccupation, obviously, here on the shore, which is crop dusting, which we see from time to time as we drive around. Tell us a little bit about Hudson and the significance here, particularly of crop dusting.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Mr. Joe was one of the fellows that rolled into the airport when I was still volunteering quite a bit in the maintenance hangar. And he had an airplane that he had just donated to the college. And I just thought that was amazing. So I asked him, you know, could I ask him some questions and find out how he got started? And what I learned was that, and he kept making references to World War II before, and then his best friend, Ten Freeman. He grew up in Harbison and would help deliver milk at 4 o'clock in the morning to the Georgetown Airport. And then he sat and watched the trainers come, and they were either practicing bombing runs or picking guys up off of this airport that basically the Navy built. In Lewis, as he went to high school, he and his best friend, Ted Freeman, didn't have a car, didn't have a driver's license, but they got a pilot's license, and they flew for Otis Smith, and they were fish spotters. This is as they were high school kids in 11th and 12th grade. Now, I just find that amazing. This is before radios. They would drop a note in a bottle over the bay, and then the note would actually give the directions of where the Menhaden were going. By the 50s, the Menhaden industry was gigantic in Lewis and basically built the town of Lewis. And so here were Ted Freeman and Joe Hudson as high school kids helping to build this industry, although he doesn't see it that way. He would never say that. Now, the sad thing is Ted went on to the Naval Academy. Joe almost went. Ted finished and decided to do his military time in the Air Force because he wanted to fly. There were no Navy aircraft then. As he continued in his career, and this is when Joe would tell the story, he'd get teary. They must have been very close. Ted was training in a T-38 in Texas and crashed. He hit a bunch of snow geese, or they hit him, went into the intake, crashed into the canopy, and to get away from the housing development, he kept going, inverted, ejected, and that was the end. When I hear this story, and then, you know, when you go over to the Cape May Lewis Ferry, you take a road that says Theodore C. Freeman Highway. That's TED. And on the Georgetown Airport facility, there are some buildings that are part of the airframe and power plant education building that are also named after TED Freeman. Now, back to Joe Hudson. He was also as phenomenal, I think. He stayed home, did farming, became a crop duster, and redesigned a spray plane himself. And I asked him, can I see your drawings? My dad was an engineer. You always make drawings. There were no drawings. He just did it. And then his work later, you know, became the way spray planes work now. He figured out how to take a Stearman and turn it into a spray plane. And, of course, now we have all kinds of spray planes that are manufactured that way. Through Joe, I met some other folks, and it still amazes me that as a young man, he could fly, would fly, made money flying, and then continued flying until just a little while ago.
Now, crop dusting in itself is a bit of an art. I mean, I was reading through, and there are things that I had not really thought about. Describe a little bit about it. I mean, I've been seeing from drift. And wires from telephone poles and that kind of thing.
I've only watched a couple of ag cats, and you can see them up and down 113. And then as you go, you know, toward Milford or Milton or, you know, the more agricultural areas, you see them. But to me, having grown up in a Navy family, my brother was a Top Gun pilot. And at one point I'd come home from college and he and my father would have the dining room table cleared and they'd have these things and they were doing these runs off of an aircraft carrier because that's what my brother did. Well, many of these pilots describe flying and doing crop dusting, much like the precision that it takes flying a jet, landing on an aircraft carrier or taking off, because you're sense of space, your spatial intelligence has to be right there. And then true, like you mentioned, there is wind. You don't see wind. You see what the wind does. You have to be able to adjust for that. There are power lines, and there's a wire that goes top of the plane that is designed to cut these power lines, but sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And then all other kinds of hazards. So it is not an easy job. But I really admire these fellas. And there is one quote in here. It's a science, not an air show. The guys who made a living as doing crop dusting, they're the only ones that know the dangers. And like I said, it's a science, but it's also, it takes a very special spatial, S-P-A-T-I-A-L, I used to tell my college students, not special with an accent, spatial, meaning your understanding of three-dimensional space. You have to have that. And these guys will tell you, too, there are pilots that are out there, but not all pilots can be crop dusters or aerial applicators, as they're called now.
I mean, the thing that struck me, and I hadn't really thought about it, was that these planes tend to flow very low to the ground in order to make sure that
low and slow.
Yeah, and you introduce at this point Debbie Schaefer. She's an organic farmer. Another side is how you label it.
Yes,
with her concerns about the impact of these kinds of pesticides and so on, say, organic farmers.
Right, and she was very polite. She was my neighbor. She passed away, oh gosh, a year ago. A young woman, very sad. We got to be friends very quickly. Mm-hmm. I met her. She was house painting. She was on the second story painting this house, and I was running at the time, and I just had to stop, and we struck up a conversation. I told her what I was doing. Anyway, her little mini organic farm sat right next to another larger farm, and her concern, and she told me, she's up on her second story window of her house, and these guys would fly toward her and then up and bank, and she said she could see their face. They were that close to the house. Now, of course, they're not going to hit the house, but her point was her farm had a buffer, which was required, but they put an additional buffer because she didn't want the spray coming over to her house. Okay, it didn't. But she helped me compose and write the other side, in other words, the view of all of this from the organic farmers and the beekeepers, their perspective on crop dusting, or in this case, aerial applications. But she did it with kindness and respect because these, you know, she knows that these guys try very hard.
Tell me about Jimmy Vreeland. I guess there's I think you have a phrase in that there's a, in terms of instruction, there's the Jimmy way.
Oh, yes. Oh, what a doll. He became such a good friend. All these guys did. He is probably best known as a flight instructor. He trained hundreds of fellows, including two in this book, Alan and Jeff Corman. And before he was a flight instructor, he was a crop duster and a commercial pilot and a, you know, a flight instructor, you know, for the commercial airlines. His mom was a teacher, and I think that's what made him such a good, good instructor. He said there was only one time when he lost it, and Ronnie Corman had... Oh, that's another brother. Ron Corman had maps or some kind of stuff all over them by the windscreen.
Right.
And he just slammed his thing down and... Because he was so concerned for safety, and then, you know, he knows that sometimes student pilots are, they're doing their best, but they're not as aware of things going flying, you know, on the inside of a cockpit as a flight instructor. And the flight instructor basically is responsible for everybody and everything in that aircraft. He's still a fine gentleman, and I learned so much from him.
And he apparently taught, I think you indicate, generations of pilots.
Yes. And again, only until just recently retired from flying and, of course, retired from teaching.
Also mentioned, by the way, that there's this image that's been created of some of these flyers being sort of rogues, pilots, that kind of thing. Where does that image, Zealand, I guess it
is. It's very real. It's very real. And I was told my... son-in-law is a major in the Marines, and he is also very interested in flying and is now working on his instrument rating. He came across this paperback book. There was a hardback book for grown-ups and a paperback book for kids, a fella out of New Zealand. And this guy told stories that just fit that stereotype about throwing garbage out, doing this, buzzing a neighborhood, just crazy stuff. And although I don't really think there's anything like that here on Delmarva, it does exist other places. And in any profession, there are the crazy guys and then there are the more serious ones. But that reputation does still exist.
But speaking of safety, apparently there are a few planes that got shot at from...
Yes.
What's that? I mean, I wouldn't think... Wouldn't think to do that, but dangerous.
It was even written in a book. Yes, there was some fellow that Jimmy told me, there was some older fellow that was taking a nap like at 5 o'clock in the evening, and Jimmy was working, and in an AGCAT, it is loud. Well, this guy was awakened, got mad, and shot at him. And then there are other times, as you can imagine. I mean, people do weird stuff on the highway as well. An airplane is a target. So, again, he told me of two times in his life when there were bullet holes in his aircraft. And only one time he could track the guy down and say, you don't want to do that anymore.
And what did the guy say?
I'm not going to repeat what either of them said. But, again, you know, Jimmy was doing his job. And, yeah, the ag planes are not quiet. On the other hand, you know, if you're taking a nap at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe you need to be doing something else.
Well, I don't know. It could be another function of aircraft are obviously the banners that we see. That's probably the thing that most of us are familiar with, and it's the Bunting family who seems to be the core of this kind of industry. Tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, obviously the family, but and the specialty that goes into banner flying.
Well, again, it was an interest of mine back from high school, and through Robbie, I was fortunate enough to meet Bob Bunting, his family, his kids, learn how the operation is run. They shared with me family heirloom photos, newspaper articles. There was even a film, a short film that was made on him while I was actually talking to Holly. And the fellow interviewed both of us and then, you know, made this, I guess you would call it a documentary, in pieces and parts. But part of it was on the Bunting family. It was called Downey Ocean Hun. And it part of it was about the Banner Plains. Now, my interest was just, I wanted to find out how all this took place. And being on their family farm, which is where the operation is now, and then just watching these guys take off or drop banners, pick up banners, and then later land was fascinating, phenomenal. I, you know, out in the middle of nowhere on a grass field.
And I understand that you don't just, like, sit the banner and drag it out, but there's a whole hooking process that goes
right
to trying to getting those things
right
up in the
there's
air.
There's a ground crew, and Jessica, their daughter, is responsible for getting the banners ready. Holly, their mom, does the scheduling. And then there's a crew of fellas, young men, who literally, with golf carts and ATVs and wagons, haul the banners out to the field. The letter banners are laid out. The logo banners are in a pile, and then both get picked up, much like the tailhook operation on an aircraft carrier. There's a very thin rope that has the banner attached, and the pilot has to swoop down, know where the grappling hook is, hook that, and fly off and bank over to one side or the other, and then head to the beach. Sometimes they pick up, sometimes they have to come around and do it again. And the banner planes will carry, I believe it's either three or four of these ropes with grappling hooks, so that when they're out flying for the day, when they finish the time that it takes to fly that banner, or drag the rag as they call it, the guy will come back. Now sometimes these have been young women too. They'll come back to the field, come in, drop it, come around, and pick up another one. They don't land. They don't sit down and have lunch or take a break. They're in the air the whole time.
And I understand that the reason why they do this sort of tailhook kind of fashion is because that these banners are pretty heavy. You wouldn't get off the ground, I guess.
Correct. Right? Correct.
So they'd also, the whole slew of, I guess, clients that they do, everything from beer companies, restaurants, that kind of thing.
Right. They have a list, and the list has changed over the years,
yeah.
But everything from, you said, restaurants, candy, insurance, hotels, sometimes it's special events, but they, and those are the logo banners, but they all, and some letters, but they also do very personal, special things. Somebody's getting married, or somebody says, I'm sorry. And then those letter banners are fashioned individually for that particular client.
And also, you have nightlights. Tell me a little bit about that.
Gosh.
I didn't realize that they were these things,
yes,
nightlights. Yeah.
Yes, there is such a thing.
I mean,
thing.
Assumes. Yeah, makes
back
sense.
Back in the day, well, it went on for a while. But back in the day, there were pilots who flew what we'll call a nighttime banner. And Joe Hudson did too. They were helium lit. It was almost like a bed screen. It was a metal apparatus that had paper, helium lights. And I remember, again, this was in the 60s. It said, Visit Ocean Playland.
Okay.
And then the other one was, that's the only one I can remember.
Okay.
But here lately, a couple years ago, there was a fellow King, Zach King, who started it again. And he used LED lights. And again, that's computer generated. And it was a scroll, but it was just a little too, I mean, it would go flying right over you and you could just barely read a word. The nighttime banners from the 60s really were much better. But the problem was, it was at night. And so, yeah, there's people on the boardwalk at night, but I don't know that it really paid as well. Now, there are actually two fellows that flew at that time. One is Jim Whaley. He still lives over West Ocean City. The other is Robert Scott. He lives close to Georgetown now. But they both flew those night banners. And I think Jim Whaley even flew in and around Baltimore, like around the stadiums. There was another fellow who tried a couple years ago out of Georgetown, but he didn't make it. No one wanted to pay. Mm. And I think the return on a night banner is not the same as in the daytime because of the number of people on the beach.
How effective are these banners? I mean, obviously somebody thinks that they're worthwhile, even this era of social media.
Oh, yes. Well, they're effective. Sometimes they will say something when they go into the restaurant or, like I said, if it's a marriage proposal or something like that, of course you'll know. But they're also effective sometimes when there's words misspelled or something's upside down, because then everybody sees that and they'll report back or tell. But yes, now I don't have facts and figures on,
right,
you know, how effective it is, but they wouldn't still be doing it.
Right. They're still business.
Right.
And then there's John Reed and son.
Oh my gosh.
Described as a pioneer, flew the Burma Hump. Tell me a little bit about John Reed and his son.
Right. Well, John Reed Jr. comes to the airport and knows my friend Robbie, and that was one of the ways that I learned about his dad. John Reed Jr. has a chicken farm, but he's also a pilot for Pleasure. And he was kind enough to give me photos of his dad and himself growing up. His dad ran the Laurel Airport for years by himself. His dad was taught by Paul Ennis, and he drove all the way down to Salisbury to learn from the best. Then John became a flight instructor. He taught Jimmy. I mean, all these guys know each other. It's really neat. But Mr. John, Big John as he was known, ran this airport in Laurel by himself, cut the grass, served coffee to people, gave flight instruction. He also ran power lines, and one of the best stories in the whole world, in other words, he was paid by Delaware to inspect the wooden poles, the power poles. One of the best stories in the world was that Mr. Timmons went up with him. He said, come on, go with me. So they're flying down this power line. He's, come here, I want to show you something. So here's this dog. He goes, watch this. So he banks around, comes around, the dog takes off, and then finally the dog gets tired. And John told the story that for years in this one area, this dog would wait because he always flew by at the same time. The dog would be there waiting, trying to outrun this plane. That's not going to happen. And then one day the dog wasn't there anymore. But anyway, neat guy. The other thing that was fascinating to me was that, and this place still lives on, there have been many hands that took over after Mr. Reed died. Now, the United States Naval Academy has a skydiving team that flies out of Laurel. And they kept their aircraft, or I should say an aircraft was kept in the Georgetown Airport, the Twin Otter, for them to practice on, and that for a while was based at the Laurel Airport. In other words, the Skydive Delmarva was working out of the Laurel Airport. Now these guys fly out of Georgetown, but I think too Laurel is a little closer for them. But I was able to meet, and again, my son-in-law helped me meet these fellas and get some pictures, and I just thought, what a neat thing. In other words, Mr. Reed was, when he had Laurel Airport, was really all about flight instruction and helping guys use the GI Bill and learn how to fly. That was his main bread and butter. Since then, airports, I think, have had to diversify to remain in business. And the Naval Academy Skydiving Club team is one of the ways that the Laurel Airport and Georgetown Airport keep going.
The other family I wanted to take a look at, by the way, is the Carter Crabb and Son, and the idea of spraying, in this particular case, for mosquitoes, invasive species. Tell me a little bit about the family and that process that takes place, we're glad it does.
Oh, yes.
but we don't want to see, right?
I've not met Matt, but I've had the occasion to meet Carter Crabb, and he has the neatest Southern accent in this world. Oh, my goodness. I could sit and listen to him all day long. He's out of Melfa. And flew out of the Accomack County Airport. in that area. That is where Matt grew up. However, after some time, and I think it was in some kind of medical salesman, something or other, he goes, I don't want to do this. So he took on what his dad did in terms of spraying, but now his business is mostly out of, if I understand it correctly, Virginia Beach and down Elizabeth City, North Carolina. So he went south. He got off, mostly off the peninsula, although he does come back. And in working with him, he was one of the people, along with Jeff Corman, who helped me realize these guys do more than just spray mosquitoes. And it's a combination of surveying, counting swans, eagles, spraying for vegetables, yes, but also spraying for the gypsy moth, trying to keep forests, you know, insect-free and healthy. And they do all of this. They do all of this. And Matt was saying, too, especially in the Virginia Beach area, that when he had a job to do, he was also mindful that he would not be spraying when people were trying to cook burgers out on the grill. So they think about that. I mean, they've got X number of hours in the day that are right for mosquito larvae or right for another insect. But they also, you know, don't want to be a burden to local neighbors.
Now, I understand that there's some people who, though, are concerned about all this spraying as it might affect them in terms of their, I guess, the same thing, I guess, is sort of a push off from, obviously, the dust cropping, crop dusting as well.
Oh,
that
sure.
People are concerned about.
Well, I'll tell you, I am. However, I remember as a teenager going to Assateague with my father, who thought it would be a great idea to rent a Jeep. Now, this was long before aerial applicators. We went down there and just got slammed with mosquitoes. You couldn't slow down the Jeep. You couldn't get out for getting nailed by the mosquitoes. Same thing here this spring with the unbelievable amount of water that we've had dropped, the puddles that still exist in some cases, and everybody's complaining about the flies and mosquitoes. And it made the news. I think even on your station, I heard it as well. The aerial applicators gave up spraying larvae. They can't. So now they're going after the adult mosquitoes, just like in the old days. And I guess I'm a weirdo, but in New Jersey, where we used to go to the shore, I can still smell, this is horrible to say, but I can still smell the DDT coming out of the back of the Jeep, coming down to each neighborhood, you know, each beach street. Everybody would shut the windows, but you would know that for a couple of days, you wouldn't get eaten alive. You know, that and tar on your feet, it just meant you were at the beach. That's what you did. But yes, there is a concern.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Deb Schaefer, bring her back here,
yep.
She was concerned particularly about effectiveness. What do you think it's effective?
Well,
from personal experience.
And she lived in New York City when West Nile virus was killing people, making them sick. And her opinion was that, you know, the spraying just was not a very good idea. On the other hand, you know, she had twin boys. She wouldn't want them stung or hurt by those mosquitoes either. So it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to balance.
And spraying, by the way, in urban areas is somewhat different. I mean, I was in Los Angeles when they decided to spray for the Mediterranean fruit fly. And mm-hmm. I can remember after if there was a spray, you had to go down and wash your car, right? Because
yep.
you didn't want this stuff yep. to eat up. So, I mean, there is a difference between that.
Oh, sure. And on a map of the United States where you look at, the herbicide that's used here. Oh, my mm-hmm. brain just quit.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Anyway. The use of this herbicide is way more in the Midwest than here, although fields here are sprayed to kill weeds, and then but it's a timed effect. And then especially like in a place in back of where we live, soybeans are, you know, directly put into the ground. In other words, it's no-till. Roundup.
Roundup. Okay,
sorry,
there you go.
I'm getting old. But again, the Roundup here, even the commercial Roundup, is not used, although some people would say, oh, no, how do you know that? Well, when you look at a map of the United States, it's used way more in the Midwest and in other places than here on Delmarva. But here, it again, my understanding is it's a very timed effect. Now, long-term on the planet, I don't know.
By the way, can't let you go without talking about Aeroshell. And the cow, which apparently wears goggles.
Yes.
and actually three shots of the cow. One she looks a little windblown, I guess, is a phrase I would use.
Well, back in the appendix, and it took me a while to learn about that, but let me back up. When I first came, where I live, there was a poster in the garage. Now, the garage had a bunch of not only, you know, vehicle parts and tools, but airplane parts and tools. And here was this poster of a cow head, a cow wearing goggles, a biplane, and large roll bales. I'm going, wow, look at that. Story of a farm animal. Looks like a movie poster. Haviator. What the Haviator? What's that? Well, it was one of the Aeroshell posters. At Oshkosh, there's a fly-in every year, usually in July, and it's sponsored by EAA, Experimental Aircraft Association. In 1993, they were going to have the first speed run. Some Formula One jet was going to come. Well, they didn't know, right close to time of the air show, which Formula One was coming. So they hollered down to the basement and said, "You guys just make us a poster, okay?" So here are these guys down in the basement going, "I don't know about airplanes. Where's Wisconsin? What's in Wisconsin?" They go, "Wait a minute. It's Dairyland, capital of the world." Got it. So they put a Holstein in goggles and a flight cap at 0 miles an hour. Then they have another one at 100 miles an hour. So like a dog with its head out the window in a car, a little bit of cheek, ears are flapping. Then they made... And a Holstein at 300 miles an hour, ears pinned back, you know, cheeks billowing out, flight scarf, everything. And very, very briefly, the folks at Shell did not like this. They wouldn't sell it. They said, "We're not selling this." Some other management said, "We'll give it away." So in 1993, they gave away the 1993 Aeroshell Speed Dash poster in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Every year after that, the guys at Aeroshell were asked to design a poster for the event, and people every year have collected them. Now, at the first part of each, I think there's five, actually, parts, it just so worked that there was an Aeroshell poster that fit either the character or the part, and the book begins with the Haviator poster and Mr. Ennis with his goggles and his open cockpit aircraft.
We've been speaking with Joanne Guilfoyle. She is the author of the book Flying Over Delmarva, Spray Planes, Banner Planes, and Biplanes. If you've ever wondered about those planes that we see over Delmarva, this is a great book with lots of photographs, by the way, which I would mention as well. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.